Be honest, are you a music nerd or a fledgling music nerd who wishes you knew more about what's out there? The All Songs Considered podcast from NPR Music is here to help. All Songs Considered is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Each week, Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best of the best new and upcoming music. Download artist interviews, live concerts, and lots of songs you'll fall in love with. Find new All Songs episodes every Tuesday at iTunes.com/NPR. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, it's Oscar week, and that means it's time for our Oscars Omnibus. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And fittingly for our Oscars Omnibus, we're joined here in the studio by our pal Bob Mondello. Bob, what do you do at NPR?
I talk about movies.
Well, we were originally planning to be doing this Oscars Omnibus in front of a live audience here at NPR in Studio One. Unfortunately, it snowed.
Yeah, now, which is going to be a little awkward because I wrote in a lot of pauses for applause into what I was going to say.
I bet
so every once
in
a while, I'm going to stand and like kind of preen expectantly.
If you could just
and no one can see us in our tuxes.
That's
So when you could just say, hold for the laugh, we'll know.
Yeah. Right, right.
I had my hair done for nothing. Mm-hmm. Although we had to postpone the live event due to snow, we still wanted to make sure that we got our Oscar conversation in, and we also didn't want Stephen to have seen all these movies for nothing.
Yeah, sunk costs, people.
Sunk costs. So the Best Picture nominees, I want to just knock out at the very beginning. The Best Picture nominees are Birdman, the film where Michael Keaton plays an actor trying to mount a play. Mm-hmm. Boyhood, which is the filmed over 12 years, Richard Linklater family drama, I should say. Selma, Ava DuVernay's historical drama about Martin Luther King Jr. The Theory of Everything, which is Eddie Redmayne and the story of Stephen Hawking. Whiplash, which is which we talked about on the show with our pal Audie Cornish, in which J.K. Simmons wins an Oscar.
Yeah, seriously.
Spoiler.
It's the story of J.K. Simmons winning an Oscar.
Playing a drum professor. The Imitation Game, in which Benedict Cumberbatch plays a version of Alan Turing, which is not terribly close to the real Alan Turing.
But very close to Sherlock Holmes.
That's there's some truth to that.
We'll get to that.
The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a very Wes Anderson-y Wes Anderson movie. And American Sniper, which is, you know, Bob wanted to share some information with us, I know, about American Sniper, because American Sniper, which is the film loosely based, I think it's safe to say, on the memoir of Chris Kyle. But as Bob pointed out, American Sniper has something else going for it that none of the rest of these movies have.
Just prior to the nominations, I was looking at the list and thinking, oh, my God, these pictures haven't made any money at all. No one's going to watch the awards.
Yeah.
And then this picture came out of nowhere. It had about $3 million in the bank prior to the Oscar nominations. It now has over $300 million.
Yeah.
And as a result, it's given people a reason to watch the Oscars. I think they're going to be disappointed.
Unless they really love sound editing.
Yeah.
Well, that's that.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that I thought was interesting when I saw American Sniper is I sort of just felt like there was less to it than meets the eye, in the sense that it's been very controversial because some people are, you know, really uncomfortable with its depiction of war. It's been pointed out, as is often the case with biographical movies and as is the case with several other Best Picture nominees, it's not a very true or even very spiritually true portrayal necessarily of the person whose life it's supposedly about. For me, it was, you know, it was probably 10 or 15 minutes of a pretty affecting movie about a guy's relationship with his wife and family and the stresses of being gone, surrounded by kind of a bunch of war movie that I didn't respond to very much.
Yeah, I responded better to that. But, I, you know, that's the thing. I saw it like a month before any of the controversy.
Yeah.
And we're watching a movie, and it's by Clint Eastwood, and it's a pretty effective war movie. And I thought, well, this isn't bad. And everybody was a little surprised to hear that at that point.
Yeah.
Then it became this juggernaut. There has to be a lot in the eye of the beholder on this one, and a lot of what the beholders are beholding doesn't feel like it's accurate to the picture. Many people have been accusing this movie of being a lot of things that it isn't, in the same way that a lot of people have been accusing Selma of things that it isn't, like, for instance, being anti-LBJ.
Right.
The marketing of this film isn't this film. This is often the case, but here it's especially true. The marketing of the film really hits those family elements you talked about, Linda, really, really hard. We see in both the trailer and in the print ads, we see the wedding scene. We see him on the phone with his wife. We see him in a bar being very emotional, suffering from what we recognize as PTSD, if the character doesn't necessarily. That's not the book. And, you know, I get that the screenwriter interviewed his wife, interviewed him, I think, as well, in making this film. I read the book. The guy who wrote the book wants you to see him as a hero and B, a badass.
Right.
And that's it.
Sure.
Whether or not this character is sympathetic is not a thing that he gives a rat's ass about.
Right.
And if you read the book, you can't help but feel those family elements as feeling disingenuous, like they were put into this film to kind of hit the classic Hollywood formula of we got to make this guy more sympathetic.
Yeah.
And it just feels like you're sanding down the hard edges of this guy to make it more palatable for the masses, because if they had made a version of the book, a straight-ahead version of the book, it would be a much more unpleasant, uglier document than this film ends up being.
Yeah.
It's this family element stuff surrounded by a very conventional war movie, a kind of a throwback war movie.
I agree.
At the heart of it, which is incredibly well directed and it's effective and moving, but there's something that feels a little off about that.
I was a little less bothered with that in this movie than I was with some of the historical inaccuracies and some of the other Best Picture nominees, which we'll get to. I think there was an effort made to make this a little bit more general and hopefully universal picture of the life of a SEAL in this situation. And I didn't necessarily have a problem with making something other than an unflinching portrait of someone who viewed war in a very specific way. I think making him a little bit more lovable and a little bit more conflicted, that didn't bother me as much. I did think this was a very well-made war movie. I think that it was a well-paced movie. It is a war movie that is very clearly in the hands of a skilled director in Clint Eastwood. I found there were some very frustrating choices made in the way the story is told. I had more problems with the grafting on of this very cheesy kind of black hat, white hat. It's a battle between one sniper and another sniper.
Right.
In the telling of that story, there is actually an unironic use of the phrase mission accomplished that I think is part of what hits people in a strange way about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, because I think that things like that are the things that feel like very unconsidered elements in a movie that is trying to be considered, I think, in some ways. And I think in that it is a movie that takes seriously the issues that people face as anybody coming back from war. That part of it, I thought, was interesting. It's funny because what Glenn is talking about with the fact that the guy is not a guy who actually experienced, according to his own book, if you take his book's word for it, did not experience a lot of conflicted feelings about being involved in war, really just wanted to do that job and felt like that was his job. And he really did not, you know, didn't suffer over it in his mind, over the rightness or wrongness of what he was doing. When I watched the movie, I thought, do I believe that this guy being played by Bradley Cooper in this movie would come home and write a book where he indicated absolutely no ambivalence at all? And I thought he would. So in a way, even though the movie is a little more touchy-feely about him than the book is, I don't know that that necessarily means that he couldn't be like he is in the movie. See what I'm saying?
The amount of posturing in that book can be covering up a certain amount of feelings that he didn't want to express in a book.
And there is a lot of that posturing in the movie, in a way, if you think it's posturing. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I just don't think it neither bothered me nor thrilled me all that much.
Yeah, but in the book, really quickly, there's also a lot of fabrication, reportedly. There's a little bit of puffing up of him testing the things that he didn't do once he comes back home, which makes it, again, a weirder, more interesting document than this right. very conventional film.
And I do want to just add, there is a piece that my friend Alyssa Rosenberg wrote in the Washington Post, where she essentially said that the issue with the movie is that they're unwilling to make a case for this guy as he really was. Mm-hmm. It's a good piece, and I will link to it.
What are you going to do this year, though? Oh, my God. I mean, Theory of Everything is based, the story of Stephen Hawking.
Let's get to Theory of Everything.
But it's based on a book by his wife, right?
Yeah,
right?
You can tell.
Yeah, and becomes a hagiography of his wife.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And as I'm looking at these pictures, Selma is a picture that's really interesting, too. You're getting these pictures of these people that are sort of hamstrung and tied up before they even get started.
Yeah, I think in terms of the Theory of Everything, which is, this again, is the story of Stephen Hawking and largely of his marriage to his first wife. Yeah. It is about the marriage, but what I found myself saying was, like, it's his Wikipedia entry to me. It's one of those biopics that kind of just hits all the inflection points of a person's life so that you feel like you're running down a checklist of all the things that happen. You know, Eddie Redmayne, I think, as Stephen Hawking in this movie, does a tremendous amount of really difficult work, right? That's a really difficult part to get right, and it's undoubtedly very physically demanding and all that stuff. But the movie, I gotta say, kind of left me cold.
The acting job was more impressive than the film, yeah. Once you get the premise, you can just feel it just sort of winding itself up and letting it go, ticking all those boxes that you mentioned. I saw this as a screener, not in the theater, and I'm pretty sure that if I had seen it in theater, I would have spent less time saying, yeah, baby, to the screen, because you look so much like Austin Powers.
Yeah.
It is uncanny, unsettling.
That's a makeup situation.
But yes.
I saw this movie under the absolute best possible circumstances. I watched an iTunes screener on my laptop, on good headphones, on an airplane. And the smallness and twinkliness of this movie was exactly right for that setting. I found it slight and sweet. The points where I found myself kind of rolling my eyes at it were the, I didn't know that much about the movie going in, except that it was about Stephen Hawking. I sat there at times thinking, God, is this approved by the Jane Hawking Tourism Board? Like, this is the most, like, right. This is such a mash note to this saintly woman.
Yeah.
And it kind of is trying to do this stuff about, like, Stephen Hawking is an atheist and she's a believer and, like, will twinkliness win out? And, like,
yeah.
You know, where she's just this, like, saintly cutie pie and not a very interesting character. I do think there is the germ of some interesting story in there about the decision to stay with this guy who has been given a very bleak medical diagnosis and say, well, I'm going to ride out these next two very difficult years. And then, spoiler alert, Stephen Hawking lives and lives and lives.
Sure.
And what does the aftermath of that decision mean?
Yeah.
Like, what does the rest of your life look like in that situation? There's some interesting stuff in there about that, but it is mostly a very small, kind of pretty, very contained little movie that I enjoyed more than I thought I would, but did not think it was, like, a best picture.
The place where that movie got me briefly, the place where I tuned into it, was late in their marriage. The story the movie tells is basically that after he is using a wheelchair pretty much full time and requires a lot of care, he meets a new woman who is his nurse. She has met someone else. And it's this idea that they have had this marriage that has been very reliant for a lot of its direction on what has happened to him. They have become good together at dealing with all of his medical issues. But then there comes this point where their relationship is just sort of not what it was because so much has changed in their lives. And I thought that was really an interesting thing to explore, but I don't think they do much exploring of it.
Yeah, that lasts about 2 or 3 minutes. I think it's a very frustrating picture and not a terribly interesting one, and I'm surprised to see it in this category. And if I had my druthers, Mr. Turner would be in that slot for the biopic. So.
Were you really surprised, Bob, that Theory of Everything was nominated? It's a very Oscars-y
movie.
It's
very Oscars-y.
Well, I thought for sure he would get nominated. There was already a British scientist movie that looked like an Oscar nominee, so I didn't think necessarily.
All right, so the other British scientist movie, which Bob saw, and Bob saw both of these in Toronto, very close together at the film festival, and was referring to it as kind of this Oxford Brit thing that was happening, is The Imitation Game, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Alan Turing, sort of. As we alluded to earlier, I think as loose as American Sniper is with the story of Chris Kyle, I think The Imitation Game is perhaps more and more problematically loose with the story of Alan Turing. And I think probably the most efficient thing for us to do is link to some of the deep dives into how true that is. Mm-hmm. I would say the bottom line is kind of, first of all, he was not as closeted and tormented about being gay as he's portrayed to be.
There's a British military leader who is depicted as bitterly opposing him, who did not oppose him at all, and is thus tarred in a way that LBJ is not even close to tarred in Selma.
Sure.
I was kind of furious
when
about
you read,
this movie.
Yeah, when you, yeah.
Like, reading an encapsulation of how many things this movie changes about history.
Yeah.
And really depicts as fact.
Yeah. And if you were an alien and you saw this film, you would think that homosexual meant kind of twitchy. I don't remember seeing a character on screen whose sexuality is so purely theoretical as Alan Turing's is in this thing. And I'm not asking for hot man-on-man action in this thing. A little would go a long way. but the sex is so coded and Byzantine and oblique, and decorous is the word that kept coming back to me. This film could have been made in 1950, dealing with some of the same subjects and feel exactly the same. It's like they want to make this guy into a gay martyr, which, fine, but they skip right past gay and go right to martyr. They spend all their time, well, a lot of their time at the end of the film, trying to make him into a martyr, but just, again, to make it more palatable for mass consumption. Because I think they want to hit all four quadrants. You can just hear the Weinsteins kind of going behind it, going, yeah, we got to make sure. Uh-huh. Let's take some of that out. It felt, again, disingenuous to me.
The really frustrating thing is that there's a wonderful play that has become a PBS show as well called Breaking the Code, which is really extraordinary and had Derek Jacobi in it doing a much better stutter.
Yeah.
And in every respect, a remarkable piece of writing, and it didn't gloss over things and it didn't make up as much. It's frustrating to see this picture elevated. I have to say it's a very well-made Oscar contender. I mean, as you're looking at it, you're thinking, okay, this is going to be up for Oscars.
Yeah, and I will take up for one thing in this movie, which is the Benedict Cumberbatch performance. Mm-hmm. I think if you, and this is a big ask, right? If you imagine that this is a fictional story, so if you put aside the issues with the real history, which you can't, but if you did, although this performance is within a hair's breadth of his Sherlock Holmes, as I think many people have noted, it's kind of his, that inaccessible, troubled genius. I was very moved by the performance. I do think he has a nice feel for that chilly, smart, kind of self-doubting guy. Mm-hmm. Even though it's a performance that I kind of felt that I had seen elements of before from him, I do think he's good in this movie. And I cared about that character. And actually, I think Keira Knightley, who does not have very much to do as the woman who kind of he became engaged to and then wasn't, and I think there's a lot invented surrounding her, but I think she's good in this movie.
I think a lot is good in this movie, but this is one of the most formulaic movies I've seen in years, in its own way. And this is a movie that I will point to every time we talk about Oscar bait. Like, in its own way, this is just as formulaic as The Equalizer or The Boy Next Door or any Lifetime movie or any number of movies that people dismiss as cookie cutter formula.
It's a genre
movie.
The genre being King's Speech.
Yeah, yes. Well, this is something Glenn has talked about with literary fiction.
King's Speech is definitely an Oscars-y movie, but there's a little bit of joy in it. This is just the most cookie cutter, forgettable, like vaguely arty Weinstein. I mean, I hate to apply Harvey Weinstein references to this movie, but you just see the strings of this is going to be an awardsy movie.
Well,
it is.
This is the first movie in English by Morton Tilden, the guy who made a phenomenal picture a couple of years ago, very different from this, called Headhunters, which is just this incredible thriller. I urge everybody to see it. It's a sensational film. I'm guessing that the Weinsteins controlled how he made this picture. And to a large extent, this is his entree into Hollywood and a different style of movie making than what he experienced in Scandinavia. And so he did a gorgeous job of doing what a Hollywood movie looks like.
The Weinsteins, and to be fair, some other folks, have created this genre of gentle British swelling music kind of stuff, some based on real history, some not. that I think influences a lot of filmmakers. Yeah. That's it for the Brits. Glenn, are you a Wes Anderson guy?
I am.
You are a Wes Anderson guy. Are you a Grand Budapest Hotel guy?
I am. I get all the critiques of this film. I mean, I get that it is, you know, a confection. It's this little piece of artifice. It's like a diorama. It's like a Joseph Cornell box. I get all those critiques. The twee thing that's always flung at him. And I think it was you, Stephen, who said twee is one of those words that when you point at somebody, three of the fingers are pointing back at you. If you use the word twee, you're saying a little something about yourself. All his stuff is animated by a sense of humor, which endears me to him. And of these eight films, this is by far the one I'm pulling for. I love that he's stepping out of the AA leagues of the... Is that a thing?
let's say it is.
Okay. Of the adapted screenplays and the screenplays world. And like the Coens before him, coming up into play with the big guys.
Right. That's a great point.
I think that's where he belongs. I really, really enjoyed this film a lot, and I hope it's going to win. It's not.
It is nice to see something with a little lightness and a little humor to it. This is like legitimately has jokes, including visual jokes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have never been an especially enthusiastic Wes Anderson person, but I enjoyed this movie quite a bit. It was so much fun to look at. I mean, to some degree, his movies are always look at the diorama.
Yep.
You know,
exactly.
But when he gets it right, boy, they are fun to look at.
Well, and this was a big hit. Going into the Oscar nominations, this was the number one picture in terms of box office in that group. And, you know, American Sniper somewhat overwhelmed
somewhat.
It. But it was very successful. It made over $59 million. It's a big deal. And for him, that's enormous. He's now in the big leagues in a way that he wasn't before because of the box office.
Yeah, and I'm really happy about that. I like his films a lot. I will say about this movie, it's not as much of a confection as a movie like Moonrise Kingdom. Moonrise Kingdom is a very, very tiny movie. There's a much darker undercurrent to this film. It's a more violent film than he usually makes. Uh-huh. It is, at times, a more depressing film than he usually makes, though, you know, he has certainly dabbled in, in sadness before. It's not a romp. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I was quite taken with it. I love Ralph Fiennes in this movie. Unfortunately, Ralph Fiennes was not nominated for Best Actor. One of these major Best Picturesy movies has a lead performance that's so light, that's so just witty and light on its feet and funny and charming. It's a charming picture. I also visually, in addition to being visually stunning, it's visually funny.
Yes.
There are actual visual jokes peppered throughout and tucked into the margins and funny signs. And I love that about it. Like, there's so much work put into not only making this movie beautiful to look at, but making it entertaining to look at.
Yeah. From a pure film-going experience, it was one of my favorite experiences of the year. And I was really happy that it had come out so early and yet was remembered come Oscar time. I was surprised by that, but I was also very pleased.
Yeah. It's a fun movie, and we're a little short on fun movies.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to mostly skip over a couple that we did full episodes of the show on that you can find in our archives, and we'll link to those. We did do an episode on Selma not terribly long ago. We did an episode on Whiplash. Bob, I remember talking to you about Selma right after you saw it, and my memory was that you had a little bit of that. Not that it wasn't good, but that it felt dutiful to you.
I felt as if it hit all the right notes, and it hit them well, and that it was a surprise for a director that I didn't know particularly well at that point, but that it somehow didn't go over the top for me.
Yeah.
You want a picture of that sort. I mean, the moments where you're talking about the big march, which turns out to be three marches, which I hadn't realized, I didn't know the history of it.
Yeah.
I realized when I saw it. When you get to that, you want that to just sort of crash through everything you've ever known and to become the biggest moment in the world. And for me, it didn't do that. It still made my 10 best list.
Mm-hmm.
I like the picture a lot, you know, and I was really gratified that it got nominated, although having just the award for best song is the other one is such a weirdness.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do you do with that? But
very common with women directors.
Yeah, that's the issue.
Sad to say. Not saying that's necessarily what happened, but it is something that has happened a few times.
Well, and with a not as well connected director.
Her only buddy is Oprah. What good is that?
That's a really good buddy.
That's the equivalent of several dozen buddies.
I was
going to
say, several dozen other good buddies are worth one Oprah. Bob, how'd you feel about Whiplash?
I liked it. I came out of it thinking it was kind of terrific. As a former musician, I played the clarinet in high school for about a minute and a half.
Yeah.
I was watching Shortcuts and thinking, well, okay, I think it's a very effective and well-made picture.
Stephen and I did a small batch episode about Boyhood, but I have not heard from Glenn or Bob about Boyhood. Bob, what are your thoughts on Boyhood?
It is going to kill me when Birdman beats it. It is going to kill me. And I, as much as I love Birdman, and I really do, Boyhood is a game changer for movies. It is a different kind of movie. It is amazing. It is 12 years of astonishing work, really. And God, it got to me. I mean, emotionally, in ways that nothing else did this year.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away by it. I think it's an extraordinary piece of work.
Glenn Weldon.
As a feat of cinematic logistics, it's unparalleled. Well, it's paralleled by the Michael Apted 7-Up films in a slightly different way. As a movie, I read an interview with Linklater where he was talking about midway through making this film, he had a crisis of confidence, and he called his editor up in a cold sweat, and he said, so the kid sees a dead bird, and he whines to his dad about selling the car? Is that a movie? Is there enough substance here? Is that enough? And I read that. And I thought to myself, oh, that was a good impulse. Probably should have followed up on that impulse, Dick. Oh, boy. Look, this is a taste thing. This particular topic, the coming-of-age story, doesn't interest me in the slightest, never has. I am glad that we are finally hearing from white, straight, adolescent males from the suburbs, because who will tell their stories? We haven't heard from them before. You know how you make this film 87% better just at the outset by changing one thing without sight unseen? Girlhood, because we haven't seen that. We've seen this film over and over again, and it did make me feel like I was hanging out with a teenager, because it's all this pseudo-intellectual, pretentious observations.
Right, the kid is still being formed. He's still being formed at the end of the movie. He doesn't come out
off as insights. Hey, you've got to watch the screens, man. We're all watching too many screens. Shut up and go back to moping. When you were moping, I could pretend that you were interesting. This film went on so long, doing so little, and I get that that's kind of the point. But this just interests me not a bit, and I just this is not for me.
Of all the Best Picture nominees, all of which are about dudes,
yeah,
all of which are about, like, the struggle of dudes to be understood, to decide that Boyhood is the problem.
I'm not deciding it's the problem. I'm saying I feel about the coming of age story the way that other people feel about superhero films, I also feel about biopics. It's just, there's nothing to it, and the fact that it is, the logistics of it are what are so impressive, and this storytelling just didn't. This kid, man, this kid got on my nerves.
It's not about the story of a kid who enters adulthood possessing great insight. That's not what the movie's about.
Right.
It's about a kid who's, like, you know, a mopey high school senior who then becomes kind of a college freshman who possesses college freshman level insight into the world. He is not done growing. He's not done being formed at the end of the movie. So you're not supposed to be watching him thinking he's right about everything. He's a kid.
We've seen this before. The dad is a charming rogue. The mom is a humorless scold.
That is not true.
The mom is not a humorless scold. And I'm very sensitive to movies where the mom is a humorless scold. The mom in this situation, and this is one of the things that I loved about the movie, the mom is one of these people who is doing her best, who repeats patterns even though you know that she in good faith is trying not to. And her story in that way is incredibly moving to me, because you can see that she loves her kids, she has the best of intentions, and there is a way that they handle her approach to the dad in which she learns over time that he is always going to be like this. She makes peace with co-parenting with this guy who is always going to be what he is. I actually think that part of what the movie is about is her learning to kind of take responsibility for finding her own way. And there is a moment, if I am recalling correctly, there is a moment in which she talks about having just thought that more would happen and having this feeling that things have just kind of gone along. And she gets to this point and she says, what was I waiting around for? And what was I thinking was going to happen?
Basically, like, where's my story in all of this?
Absolutely.
I felt exactly the same way.
I think that you are confusing features for bugs. I think that you're looking at this movie and saying, this kid is really not a profound person. which I think the movie knows.
Yeah.
I mean, you're noticing that the mother's story is marginalized, and I think the movie knows that, and she voices that, and that's part of what the movie is about. So it is a movie that I very much love, and I will passive-aggressively link to the essay that I wrote about it when it came out. From something that is not for Glenn to something that is sort of not for me, we will talk about Birdman, which I know Bob really loves. Bob, why don't you talk a little bit about what you like about Birdman? Now, Birdman is the story of an actor played by Michael Keaton, who used to be in superhero movies in which he played Birdman. And he is trying to make a big, I guess, comeback, but also quest for respectability, I guess, by mounting a Broadway play based on Raymond Carver's story.
You've just articulated most of what interests me about this picture, which is that it is about the intersection of movies and theater and different styles of acting. And it manages to be about that by pretending to be a single continuous take, which is what any Broadway actor does every night, right? And that is complicated enormously by the fact that a movie camera has to move around the people as they're talking. And so it's really difficult to make it seamless. I was fascinated by the way that the picture was made and the fact that it's about this all these intersections in acting styles, in dramatic styles, in narrative styles, and that it's very articulate about all those things, and that it has this fabulous score. Oh my God, it's so fabulous, and it's not nominated for anything because they decided that just drums wasn't enough.
Hmm. Yeah, it wasn't eligible.
Right.
The score wasn't eligible.
Right, wasn't eligible. Glenn, Birdman.
I don't know whether or not I like this film. I still don't know whether or not I liked it. And as I was walking out of the theater, I thought to myself, I don't know whether or not I like this film, but I also know that that doesn't matter because this film likes itself more than enough for both of us. There is a smugness to the proceedings, a self-satisfaction that permeates this film, which is occasionally shot through, lightened up by things like the performances, particularly Emma Stone, who is amazing, who cuts right through that layer of self-satisfaction. The technical mastery on display, as Bob mentioned, that's the continuous take thing. And also there's the imagery. There's lots of really beautiful things going on in this film. I don't think it's critique of Hollywood and of blockbusters and of superhero films and of acting.
Of criticism?
Well, that's the thing. I will say one thing. But anytime a film even takes a sort of a slight oblique look at, you know, being self-critical about the Hollywood process or anything, it gets overpraised because there's nothing that critics and actors and certainly the Academy love more than, see, we're taking shots at our own self here. So let's promote the hell out of this film because it has a slight viewpoint about Hollywood. A lot of critics really slammed that one scene in the bar between Keaton and the theater critic where the theater critic says, I'm going to destroy your play because you're a hack.
Because I hate you.
Because yeah. I hate you. And a lot of critics really zeroed in on that and said, well, they don't understand what criticism is. And of course, that's the point where the film's mission statement came through for me. I mean, that's the point where we realize this whole day that we're living is being seen through the point of view of an egomaniacal, narcissistic person with a persecution complex. Everything gets flattened by that viewpoint. And again, occasionally, the one thing that can kind of rise up above it is the main character has with his daughter, played by Emma Stone, and that's real. But the ending is where this film lost me. I'm not going to discuss what exactly it is, but the ending, I've read paeans to this final few images in this film all over the internet, and boy, that bugged me. It put the artsy in fartsy. I heard myself going, oh, how are European? You know, like Barney from The Simpsons. It just felt so smug and self-important in a way that really almost destroyed the film for me. But
you understand this is a comedy, right?
It's
a comedy, and in addition to that, it's a satirical comedy that mocking everybody there.
That's the last refuge of the pretentious when they're saying, "Well, I'm mocking everybody. I'm an equal opportunity mocker."
Bob pretentious?
No,
I'm talking about the director. I'm talking to Ritu.
I'm sitting over here forgiving Glenn by the moment for his thoughts on Boyhood. First of all, that incredibly innovative ending is incredibly innovative if you've never seen a Daffy Duck cartoon.
Absolutely.
Second of all, you know, you were talking about this comes down to a matter of taste. I flat out, straight up, did not pick up what this movie was putting down. I didn't like it at all. I had the reaction that many people did, apparently, to that scene with the critic in the bar. If you're going to portray something that is a central element of your movie, like, know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
The more I think about this being Hollywood's view of itself, like, it's not taking shots at Hollywood at all.
I know.
It's so self-congratulatory. It's like, we're all trying to make art, man. We all just want to make art.
Exactly.
To me, the words that came through this movie over and over again were, art, man.
Bob, talk about, I want to give Bob a chance.
Puzzled by your reaction to it more than I am. I don't think this picture deserves most of the things you're saying about it. Iñárritu is making a little comedy about things that happen in show business. It's not much more complicated than that, and it isn't trying to do very much more than be this really neat stunt. It involves actors in styles of acting which are unusual. The script isn't covering a day. It's covering weeks and weeks and weeks, so that it's not intended to be realistic in any way. And that applies also to the coverage of an idiotic portrayal of a critic. Being offended by that sort of thing seems sort of beside the point. I loved what he managed to do in this picture, which I thought was in its way as innovative and as interesting as what they did in Boyhood and in Grand Budapest Hotel. And what I admire about this year's choices for Best Picture are that those three pictures are all directorial statements that are really complicated and interesting and unlike the stuff like Theory of Everything and right. Imitation mm-hmm. Game and the things that are conventional Oscar choices.
Sure.
And it really pleases me that Birdman and Boyhood are widely regarded as the front runners. It's almost inconceivable that one of the other ones is going to win.
I think everyone is right. I think everyone is right. Because I agree with Bob that what I liked about this movie is I like the fact that it has ideas. And I think if you're going to, as we have been, say, I'm tired of this kind of movie, I'm tired of this kind of movie, Glenn is tired of movies with feelings.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to say I'm tired of a bunch of kinds of movies, you got to give it up for a movie that has a bunch of things it's trying to do. A movie that is, as we've been saying about movies in recent weeks, a big swing. And that this movie is a big swing.
And it's got some fine performances.
It has some terrific performances in it. To me, the more, and I agree with Glenn about this, the more it was about Michael Keaton and Emma Stone, the more I plugged into it. I did not plug into the whole Edward Norton business at all.
I sat there watching him just feeling your boiling hatred.
Did not
through
care.
Time.
Did not care. But I like the fact that they're trying to do stuff. At the same time, I think this movie has resonated with some parts of Hollywood because it contains that kind of artists are the real heroes and all that stuff, which you can make that movie. There are plenty of wonderful movies about how artists are the real heroes. Perhaps Bob thinks Mr. Turner is one.
or Whiplash.
But the problem with the scene with the critic, and I agree with Bob that it is all meant to clearly be bent reality. But I think if you're trying to portray it as like, you know, this guy is kind of weirdly plugged into the universe in this way, it also makes it feel like he's seeing a fundamental truth, which is that this critic is saying, I'm going to kill your play because I hate you. I'm not sure that the movie thinks that that's an idiotic thing for him to believe. And I think that whether or not, it's one of those things, in fact, it has this in common with American Sniper, which is I am much more comfortable with the movie if I don't have to think about ways that the movie might be interpreted that I might not think it even intended to be interpreted. And so I do suspect that there are at least some people out there who like saw that critic do that and they were like, that is so true, man. They're just all a bunch of haters. It's all about the art. And it's like, I don't necessarily think that's what the movie is saying, but I think it plays into that. Anyway, I mean, I thought it was, it's not for me, but I thought it was
I like the fact that we never really know if the play is supposed to be any damn good.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I really like that. Leaving that bit of ambiguity in the mix is something that I didn't trust him to do. He did. I like that a lot.
So that is all 8 Best Picture nominees. Do you have closing thoughts, Bob Mondello, as our resident actual movie critic?
Well, there's a reason that I've been talking about dollars so much as we're doing this. I've done some research about what happens in the past. There's an Oscar bump every year.
Sure.
It's supposed to be the average Oscar bump across all pictures in the last 3 decades has been about 22%. There are 2 pictures that were not in theaters anymore, Boyhood and the Grand Budapest Hotel, and so they didn't get an Oscar bump.
Right.
The other ones, The Theory of Everything got 30%. Birdman is up 40%. Whiplash is up 70%. You hear how much higher these are than usual. Mm-hmm. Imitation Game is up 90%. Selma is up 200%. And American Sniper is up 10,000% with an asterisk.
So what does that refer to? When you say 200% for Selma, that means...
That movie hadn't opened very wide.
Well, it had, in fact. It had opened pretty wide by the time the Oscar nominations came out.
But that would mean it has basically tripled the amount of money that it's made since...
It went from, say, $20 million to $60 million over the course.
Gotcha.
Now, the 10,000% jump is because this is the one picture that had not opened wide.
Right.
American Sniper was in four theaters until the day before the Oscars were announced. And that day, it went into 4,000 theaters.
Yeah.
And, of course, it went crazy after that.
So that is a bit of an asterisk.
So that is an asterisk. But the other ones are all higher than the average. So this was a year in which the Oscar nominations, because these are small pictures and critic-loved pictures as opposed to audience-loved pictures, the Oscar bump is enormous this year. This year is going to go into the history books with a lot of asterisks.
Very good. Thank you very much, Bob Mondello. Now, Bob, if you had to guess what was going to win Best Picture, what would you go with?
I'm guessing it's going to be Birdman, and I really want it to be Boyhood.
Glenn?
Birdman, because you can't underestimate how much the Academy loves talking about acting in movies and wonderfulness and the magic of the screen, dreams given life, and blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm. Weirdly, I agree with both Bob and Glenn. I agree. I think it's going to be Birdman, but I do think the takeaway this year is going to be that the awards are more spread out than they've maybe ever been. I think every Best Picture nominee is going to win something except The Imitation Game.
Interesting.
I think American Sniper is going to win like sound editing. I think Selma's going to win song. There are clear acting wins, I think, for Whiplash and Theory of Everything. I think they're going to be more spread out than they've ever been, and your leading winner is going to have like three or four.
I think it is going to be Birdman for the cold, simple reason that several of the guilds have already given out their awards, SAG and the producers and the directors, and they seem to be going Birdman. Which means, you know, that's who votes. So it seems reasonable to me. My big regret...
It means that after 4 hours of watching this thing, I'm going to be angry.
Yeah. My big regret is going to be that more didn't happen surrounding Wild with Reese Witherspoon, which I think is great. And I managed to get that little plug in there. And that
I feel the same way about the Lego movie.
Yeah. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I am neck deep in the Austin 100, as I will continue to talk about until it goes live, at which point I will talk about it some more. I'm finding great little discoveries left and right. I think it's going to be an amazing list. But I just brought in a song by an artist I thought was going to be on the Austin 100 until I found out she wasn't going to be at South by Southwest. So it's just a song recommendation by a Norwegian singer named Aurora, 18 years old, and this wonderful, beautiful, kind of soaring pop confection of a variety that I really like. I like my pop music to soar. This wonderful little song is called Under Stars. Under Stars. Smooth under his skin. That is Under Stars by Aurora, who will not be on the Austin 100 because she's not coming to Austin, but I thought it was a charming little song.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
The film that I can't get out of my head from the last year, which is not going to ever be Oscar nominated, never would be, because it's a little too weird, is Under the Skin, starring Scarlett Johansson, directed by Jonathan Glazer, based on the novel by Michael Faber. It is a genre picture. That's all I'm going to say about it, because the less you know about it going in, the better. It's weird. It's spiky. It's filled with these very dark, beautiful images. It's haunting in the sense that I can't get it out of my head. It's not a crowd pleaser. It fills you with that sense of, I have no idea where this film is going, but I know the filmmakers do. And that is a very rare thing. The last time I experienced anything like that was a film that I loved from a few years back called Hannah. Kind of captures some of that same energy. Under the Skin, not an Oscar nom, and shouldn't be, frankly. But man, it was great.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what's making you happy this week?
I found out that a picture that I was really crazy about that only opened in six theaters is on video on demand. I should have done my homework ahead of time. It's that lovely little musical. You and I both saw it in Toronto, called The Last 5 Years, in which his story goes from start to finish and her story goes from finish to start, and they sing one duet and it's right in the middle.
Share your life with me
forever,
for the next 10 lifetimes.
Forever,
for a million summers till the world
It's a beautiful, beautiful little movie. I listened to the soundtrack the other day, and it just about killed me. It's almost as much as seeing the movie did, because most of the movie is in the soundtrack, because the vast majority of the movie is sung. In fact, I think maybe the entire movie. It's a gut punch. You got to see it, Thompson. You're going to cry. It's, it's wonderful.
That's a really, really high bar you've set.
But Glenn should not go. Yeah.
No. Not up ever. Glenn's alley. Not up Glenn's alley. But up Stevens. I'm going to try to get you to watch that at some point.
It isn't hard because it's on video on demand. I simply didn't realize that it was available to everybody. But the fact that it opened only in New York and Los Angeles last week shouldn't keep you from seeing it.
Last 5 years, Anna Kendrick and Jeremy Jordan.
I don't know, man.
Wonderful.
I don't know, man. Video on demand, schmidio on demand. It's hard for me to do anything right now.
Well, thank you, Bob Mondello. I got a couple of very quick things. First of all, there is a piece in Slate in which my pal and friend of the show, Joe Reed, ranked all 60 movies that are nominated for any sort of Oscar this year. He saw every single thing, ranked them from 1 to 60. Be surprised how many Best Picture nominees are in the bottom 10.
50.
It is great fun. Oscars Joe is the best Joe. He gets super into writing about the Oscars, and it's a magnificent piece, and you should take a look at it. Also, just a little personal news. You may hear this week from me on Twitter. You may have heard this week from me on Twitter by the time this goes out there that on June 4th, I am doing an event at 6th and I. With Judy Blume, which I was 11 once. You know what I mean? Pretty amazing. And many of my lady friends who love books, of which you know I have many, are very excited
about
it.
I'm very excited. I'm not one of your lady friends, and I'm very excited. I read the hell out of Judy Blume books as a kid.
It's a fantastic thing. And finally, I do want to mention, it's always weird when memorial stuff comes up in the making me happy, because it's of course never the loss of the person that makes you happy. But I do want to briefly mention that the New York Times columnist David Carr, who is featured in the documentary, among many other accomplishments, is featured in the documentary Page One about the New York Times, also wrote a memoir called Night of the Gun, which we talked about here on the show one time. And I had mentioned the only thing that I kind of questioned about it was that he writes so evocatively and vividly about a very difficult stage of his life in which he was using drugs and living a very dangerous life to himself and his kids and all that stuff. He makes it sound kind of exciting because he's such a vivid writer. But at any rate, he passed away a week ago as we tape this, essentially. And 1 week before he died, apparently according to the reports of complications from lung cancer, I saw him moderate a panel at the New School in New York about the future of podcasting and audio. And it was an enormous pleasure to see him talk to a bunch of people who did really different things than he did. Alex Blumberg was there. Sarah Koenig was there from Serial. Elise Spiegel was there from Invisibilia. It was a great thing to kind of watch him engage with something that is not his area of necessarily specialty, but an area of great curiosity. He gave Elise Spiegel and Sarah Koenig a lot of friendly guff over how successful their shows were. He teased Alex Blumberg about every episode being a startup, Alex's newest show, about being about what a terrible boss he is. It was great fun, and you would not have looked at the guy and necessarily thought that this was about to happen. But it was a great pleasure to me to get to see him in a lot of ways, his best incarnation, which is him talking about new stuff that is exciting and cool that he doesn't really know about, but he's really curious about. And it was a great pleasure to get to do that. I encourage you to seek out some of the tributes to David Carr that have been written in the last week. So getting the opportunity to see that and read some of those remembrances is, in fact, among the things making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, Bob at Bob_Mondello, and Jessica Reedy, our producer, at Jessica_Reedy. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our In-N-Out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thank you so much to all of you for being here at our non-live show.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Be honest, are you a music nerd or a fledgling music nerd who wishes you knew more about what's out there? The All Songs Considered podcast from NPR Music is here to help. All Songs Considered is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Each week, Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best of the best new and upcoming music. Download artist interviews, live concerts, and lots of songs you'll fall in love with. Find new All Songs episodes every Tuesday at iTunes.com/NPR.